Okay, welcome back. Hour number three on this Friday night. We're going to wrap up the week in terms of the coronavirus catastrophe that has befallen this country and many around the world, except for Sweden. They're doing pretty well there. A lot of headlines here. Let's see where we want to start here. First of all, Chris Christie, as you know, was one of those, I think they're 37 now, who have tested positive. Christie is hospitalized. He's battling the coronavirus. He's not doing, I guess, really well, not as well as Donald Trump apparently did with the medications he got. One would think Christie's getting the same sort of protocols. We don't know. There's a number of good stories and headlines up right now that you should read and look and consider. Fauci is now saying that the White House hosted a super spreader event. Well, I think that certainly covers a lot of it. What else do we want to mention here? Two more White House resident staff, that's residents staff, have tested positive, bringing it up to 37 by my count. California mandates all food must be consumed with an intravenous drip to ensure that masks are never removed. Hope you all saw that one. It's called satire. Satire. 400,000 small, although I wouldn't put it past Comrade Newsom to go close to that. 400,000 small businesses closed down in just 3 months, beginning in March in the U.S. That's a lot. A lot. Okay, the theater shutdown at Broadway, on Broadway in New York, is extended until next spring. These are going to be some very difficult months ahead. We know that by all measures. Henry, welcome back. It's Friday. Let's see what you got in your bag for us tonight.
Well, it's good to be back, Jeff. Activity is really increased dramatically in the last couple of days, and they kind of cover the gamut. I guess I was going to start with one that came out yesterday, which was the editorial board of the New England Journal of Medicine.
Right.
I had mentioned a week or two ago Scientific American had come out with an editorial that had endorsed Biden, which is extremely unusual for a scientific publication. Scientific American's been publishing, I think, for 150 years, and they've never endorsed anybody previously. And the same just happened yesterday for the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, this is a scientific journal, one of the top journals for medical research, and I don't know, I should have checked, but I think they're closer to 200 years old, and they do editorials, but they usually, the editorials are have to do with new treatments or things along those lines. They're generally not political at all, and certainly not nothing like this one, which I just wanted to kind of quote a few of the comments in here, the beginning, the end, and one or two in the middle.
Let me ask you this before you start. Were you, this is really is unprecedented for a scientific journal to do. How did that strike you? Were you shocked by it? What do you think? What are your thoughts?
No, not at all. Science is united against Trump. Trump is not. He's united against science, and they have had enough. I mean, it's utter bullshit, and they are not going to take it anymore.
That's
they
one of those French words that Henry uses sometimes.
Right. No, it's the ones Trump uses all the time. He was on for 2 hours with Rush Limbaugh today. Use it very, very frequently with using that type of language.
But that's the steroids doing it, Henry. It's steroids. It's right.
Well,
it was fine before the steroids.
Yeah. Well, I think Trump is like steroids for scientists. I mean, he can't get them riled up. And So I'm not at all surprised at this. I was a little surprised at the tone because, you know, scientific articles are usually fairly dry and they, you know, just stick to the facts. And this does stick to the facts, but, they kind of use words like, crisis and tragedy. Scientists don't usually use those words. They give you the data and you kind of make your own judgment.
Those are lurid words for science. You're right.
Yeah. So here, let me just read you a little bit from the beginning to the end and a couple in the middle here. The title is a little striking. The title is Dying in a Leadership Vacuum. And it starts out with COVID-19 has created a crisis throughout the world. The crisis has produced a test of leadership. With no good options to combat a novel pathogen, countries were forced to make hard choices on how to respond. Here in the United States, our leaders have failed that test. They have taken a crisis and turned it into a tragedy. The magnitude of this failure is astonishing. According to the Johns Hopkins Center for Systems and Science and Engineering, the United States leads the world in COVID-19 cases and deaths due to the disease, far exceeding the numbers in much larger countries such as China. The death rate in this country is more than double that of Canada, exceeds that of Japan, a country with a vulnerable and elderly population, by a factor of almost 50, and even dwarfs the rates of lower middle income countries such as Vietnam by a factor of almost 2,000. COVID-19 is an overwhelming challenge, and many factors contribute to its severity. But the one we control is how we behave. And the United States, we have consistently behaved poorly. And then in the middle, just to give you some numbers, they say that China reduced its death rate to a reported 3 per million as compared to more than 500 per million in the United States. Mm-hmm. Countries that had far more exchange with China, such as Singapore and South Korea, have intensive testing early, along with aggressive contact tracing and appropriate isolation, and have relatively small outbreaks. And New Zealand has used the same measures taken with its geographic advantages to come close to eliminating the disease, something that has allowed that country to limit the time of closures and to largely reopen society to a pre-pandemic level. In general, not only have many democracies done better than the United States, but have also outperformed us by orders of magnitude. Why has the United States handled this pandemic so badly? We have failed at almost every step. We had ample warning, but when the disease first arrived, we were incapable of testing effectively and couldn't provide even the most basic personal protective equipment to healthcare workers and the general public. And we continue to be way behind the curve in testing. While the absolute number of tests has increased substantially, the more useful metric is the number of tests performed per infected person, a rate that puts us far down the international list, below such places as Kazakhstan, Zimbabwe, and Ethiopia. Countries that cannot boast the biomedical infrastructure or the manufacturing capacity that we have. Moreover, a lack of emphasis on developing capacity has meant the U.S. test results are often long delayed, rendering the results useless for disease control. And it's a long editorial, so I'll just go right to the end here. Right to the last paragraph. and they kind of talk about 200,000 Americans that have died, and some of the deaths were unavoidable. But although it is almost impossible to project the precise number of additional American lives lost because of weak and inappropriate government policies, it is at least in the tens of thousands in a pandemic that has already killed more Americans than any conflict since World War II. Anyone who recklessly squandered lives and money in this way would be suffering legal consequences. Our leaders have largely claimed immunity for their actions. But this election gives us the power to render judgment. Reasonable people will certainly disagree about how many political positions, about the many political positions taken by candidates. But truth is neither liberal nor conservative. When it comes down to the response to the largest public health crisis of our time, our current political leaders have demonstrated that they are dangerously incompetent. We should not abet them and enable the deaths of thousands more Americans by allowing them to keep their jobs. So this was yesterday's editorial by the New England Journal. And, you know, like I say, there's words in there that you don't usually get from scientists. They usually kind of give you the facts and let you make up your minds on, you know, what's a tragedy and what, you know, unconscionable, da-da-da-da. But they actually spell it out in this editorial. Like I say, the scientific community is fed up. I mean, the guy lies, you know, every day over and over again about the most basic information. I mean, he won't say when his last negative test was. He won't say whether he's been tested, and he hasn't. He hasn't given the results of his recent tests. He's going to disregard CDC guidelines. CDC guidelines are that if you are severely infected, you should wait 20 days before. You should be isolated for 20 days. He hasn't even got to 10 days since he was officially diagnosed, which was last Thursday. So he's like at day 8. He was talking about going out tomorrow. To start rallies.
That's
and
right.
He couldn't really line it up for Florida. So instead, he's going to have one on the White House lawn, on the South lawn. So he's going to use the White House now.
Is he inviting the public in? I don't know. Henry, is he inviting the public to show up, his supporters? Or is this going to be a virtual thing?
They are hoping for 2,000 guests. So they're looking to put 2,000 people on the South Lawn, which is the scene of the crime. This guy is like an arsonist. After he goes, he creates his crime, he comes back to look over the damage, or at least revel in how powerful he was. And he's going back to where he was exactly 2 weeks ago, when they had what Fauci called a super spreader event. And it looks more and more like the super spreader was Donald J. Trump, because he won't say when his last negative result was. And he basically won't say whether he abided by the rules of the Cleveland Clinic, which was if you're going to come to the debate, you have to have been negative for at least 3 days prior to the event. And his spokesman wouldn't even acknowledge that. They wouldn't even acknowledge that he had been tested within 3 days of the debate. And the only testing he's acknowledged were the tests that were done on Thursday afternoon, a quick test, which was positive, and then it was confirmed by a PCR test that he announced at, like, 1 a.m. on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he can't even say that he abided by the rules of the Cleveland Clinic, which was in charge of the debate. So he went to the debate infected. And he was standing there yelling.
We discussed that the other night. Yeah.
Right.
We thought so.
Right.
And it looks like it.
Right.
Yeah.
But there have been more developments. He had a spokesman out today who was asked directly, when was he last tested? And he hemmed and hawed and refused to answer. And then he was asked specifically, well, did he meet the requirements? Had he been tested? Was he negative within 3 days of the debate? And he would not, if he was, he would just say yes. He would say, certainly, he's in compliance. He was in compliance. He was tested, over 2 weeks ago now. He didn't say that. He wouldn't answer that. The guy has not been tested, and it's not HIPAA. He used to say all the time, I get tested almost every day. I don't need a mask. I've been tested day in and day out. I'm always negative. There's no need for a test. Now he's positive. And the question is, well, when were you last tested? And it's been asked for over a week now, and nobody has given an answer, which is in fact an answer.
Don't
the answer is don't hold your breath. He's answered the question. The answer is he wasn't tested. He hasn't been tested for some time. So he's given the answer by refusing to answer and by refusing to let his doctors answer and by refusing to let his spokespeople answer.
There's another non-answer. And, what was that? There's another non-answer recently about another issue. I can't remember, but there was a non-answer.
Well, the other question that he was asked three times today whether he's been tested since he's been discharged. Has he tested negative now? Because he says he's not infectious. He says he's not infectious based on how he feels. And he's on steroids. He feels fine.
Isn't he leaning on his doctor and saying the doctors say I'm not infectious? I think he is.
No.
Conley?
No.
Didn't
he
say Conley said he was not infectious?
No. Rush asked him whether he's been tested, which is the only way you know whether he's infectious or not.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, not yet. Tomorrow. Tomorrow, I think they're going to test.
Well, there's a reason to get up in the morning to find out what happens. Okay.
He asked him three times in a row, and he kept changing the subject. He would not say, yes,
I
was tested.
Why
don't
you just say, not yet,
I'm
going to do it tomorrow. Just leave it alone. Come on, Donald. Get smart. Just say no. I'll do it tomorrow before I go out in public.
Yeah. Right. Because there's not going to be any results tomorrow.
He's being poisoned. The Russians did it.
There's not
going to
be any results tomorrow because he'll be positive. He'll be positive. And if he's positive...
He plans on holding
rallies every day next week. Monday he's starting in Florida.
Don't be surprised if there aren't 10,000 people there tomorrow outside the fence. Don't be surprised. I'm not saying it will or won't. I'm just saying don't be surprised.
They're hoping for 2,000 inside the fence. Outside the fence, you're pretty far away. They're hoping for 2,000 on the South Lawn. I think they're going to mandate face masks, but I don't know. And speaking of face masks, Redfield has been told that he should. CDC wrote up recommendations that for all public transportation of any form, whether it's airplane, bus, train, that all passengers are mandated to wear face masks. And they wrote that up as their recommendation because everybody except for Donald expects a fall wave. And in fact, the data, I'll go over briefly, is showing that that wave has probably already started. That yesterday there were 55,000 cases. Today it's going to get close to 60,000. And it'll top 60,000 next week, and I wouldn't be surprised if it goes up to 70,000, which would be an all-time high. And so the fall wave has begun. And so the CDC can know what they can interpret data. They can see how many cases there are. They can see these cases where your biker buddies in South Dakota and North Dakota.
Be nice to my friends now. All right.
Have the highest per capita increase in the country. So North and South Dakota used to be really, really low. Not a whole lot of people up there. They currently lead the nation in the number of per capita increase. Now they don't have a whole lot of schools up there. It's not like they got a lot of university. They've got all these students, you know, flooding the state from all over the country. But they did have, I don't know, how many were there? 30,000, 300,000, I don't know what it was. They had a lot of bikers up there. There you go, 250,000. And there's one study that said that a month later, they basically followed their phone. They basically, it was anonymous, but they could see what phones drove into South Dakota and what phones drove out of South Dakota. And then they looked at what counties those phones went to, and then they looked at the rate in those counties, and they concluded that 20% of the cases in the United States about a month after that celebration were linked to that celebration. So they were accounting for 20% of the cases in the entire country came from that biker rally. So 250,000 people maybe wasn't such a good idea. And now South Dakota and North Dakota are number one in the country as far as the per capita rate. I mean, they're both in the 600-700 cases a day, both states. And there aren't that many people in North or South Dakota. And so that's, you know, if you take their population into account, they are number one.
Are we getting an infected case fatality rate from these sources yet?
No, it's too early. It takes time for the people to die. Overall, the death rate is down somewhat in the U.S. It's probably because the increase in cases are being led by young people, and they're not going to have as high a hospitalization rate, and they're not going to have as high a fatality rate. But they are going to pass it on to, you know, the ones in school are going to pass it on to their teachers. And, you know, they're going to Thanksgiving break coming up or winter break or Christmas break, whatever we want to call it, is coming up. And they'll start moving that virus to an older population. And by December, January, February is when most of the deaths are from flu. And it's likely the same thing will happen with COVID. People will come home for break, they'll take some precautions. It might not be as bad as it could be, but it'll get
any
bad.
Influenza cases yet, Henry? Still too early?
No, still too early on influenza. There really hasn't been much information. But on, like I say, yesterday there were 55,000 COVID cases, 917 deaths. Today's not quite complete. Nebraska hasn't reported yet. They'll probably be good for 600, 700. California hasn't really updated. That'll probably be good for another 1,000 or so. And right now there's 56,794, so it's almost 57,000. So it'll be about 59,000 for the day, which, like I say, it'll go down for the weekend. So tomorrow, Sunday and Monday won't be that high, but starting on Tuesday, it'll start going back up again. And by this time next week, I will virtually guarantee that the number of cases in the United States, confirmed cases, will be in the 60 to 70 range. And the only reason I could be wrong is it'd be more than 70. It's not going to be less than 60. So this is the beginning of the fall wave. People are going to spend more time indoors. The virus just needs, you know, other bodies to infect. And the best way to do that is indoors as opposed to outdoors.
What's the total infection number now, the projection, Henry, in this country? 7 million? What is it? Do we know?
How many people have been
infected? How many people have been
determined
to be infected by whoever's doing the counting? So far in the U.S., how many cases in the U.S.?
Oh, let me give the
6 or 7 million, I think.
Worldometer is at 7,894,400.
Okay, almost 8 million. Yeah.
Almost 8 million, yeah.
Okay.
And they've got the deaths.
That means we have 322 million more yet to be infected. This thing's going to run forever.
Right. Everybody's, I mean, just as a reminder, you know, there's people that say, oh, these are all overcount, da, da, da. The number of confirmed cases is an undercount. I mean, there's 7,894,000 that have been lab confirmed. That doesn't mean that's everybody. There's probably at least that many that are infected.
Or it could be three
infected.
Times, four times that many. We don't know.
Right. This is a lab confirmed number. So, you know, I wouldn't put this at the high end. That's just how many people have taken a test, most of which are PCR. Some of them are antibodies, but I think 90% of it is PCR. So 7 million are PCR confirmed, the 800,000 maybe antibody confirmed. And there's a lot of people that have been infected that were never tested. There's a lot of people that have been infected and died before the EMS arrived, and they never get tested. And, you know, they put them down as probable if they mention COVID on their death certificates. But if they don't mention it, then they're just,
let me change a little bit here. Europe is getting, I'm sure they're all saying, second wave. Europe is getting explosive numbers in the UK and France, and they're really having a major uptick. And I wonder what your take on that is. It's the Italian strain has been there. So what are we seeing?
We're seeing the fall. most of the uptick is in the northern hemisphere. It's fall going to winter, and so people spend more time inside. And if they're inside, the virus is more easily transmitted. You know, it does best with close contact. It does best with if you've got air that's recirculated. And a lot of the countries in Europe basically got their numbers down low. And so they thought that once the numbers are low, they can start easing up. Or people just got used to the low numbers and started going out and about. And then the virus started to pick up, and people kept going out and about, and the numbers started to take off. I mean, that's the way the virus works. The virus needs hosts, and if the hosts are contact traced and isolated, the virus kind of struggles to infect a lot of people. If people say, oh, the virus is gone, we don't have to worry about it, we can go out to eat, we can go, go to the gym, we can go do X, Y, and Z, we can go back to school. And then there's more contact, and there's more contact, the virus spreads, and
okay,
and the
let
cases
me jump.
Go up. So,
I'm trying to get a lot of information here to run through your scientific mind. This is important. Are you beginning to see, have you seen, are you noticing any indication that having been infected, and I'm talking about all infections, is yielding any statistics that would suggest, now we got long haulers, I know that, that there are observable long-term changes, not long haulers, but long-term changes or changes, period, in those who have had this virus because of the polybasic cleavage. Are we seeing that?
Yeah.
Are these people being, have they been damaged? That's my question.
I'll give you a boots on the ground example. It's a relative.
Right.
Of my wife, okay? He's 60 years old. I don't know, he's probably 62 years old.
Right.
He was obese. He went on a diet. He got his weight down. And then he kind of put it back on just in time for COVID. Okay. His wife got infected. His daughter got infected and he got infected. His wife and his daughter did relatively well. He not so much. He ended up fainting and they were monitoring his oxygen levels. His oxygen levels got down into the low 90s. And they called an ambulance. He went to the emergency room. Took him into the emergency room. They took a look. They kind of took his history. And they said, you're okay. Not a big deal. You're probably infected. They didn't test him. They said, you're probably infected, given the fact that your wife and daughter are positive. And, you can go home, and if you got any problems, it gets worse, give us a call or check back in. And then they reported to his brother-in-law, who's a cardiologist, okay? And they said, he probably has COVID. We didn't test him, but, judging from his history, he's probably positive. And, his oxygen levels really aren't that bad. And, he seems fine, except for this, I don't know what they called it, something. They might even have said congenital, but, this, about this
congenital.
Heart issue, but, about this heart issue.
Right.
And, that's probably been there for a while. That's nothing new. And the cardiologist says, he doesn't have any heart problems. And I said, I don't know. And so they took him back in. And they had him in the hospital for a couple more days. He did okay. He got discharged. He recovered. And now he's got atrial fibrillation. Never had it before. He's got it now. Mm-hmm. And everybody's assuming that he got it because of the COVID. So he's got a heart issue. Didn't have a heart issue before he got infected. They noticed it in the emergency room. And they thought it was not new. They thought it was something that his doctor already knew about, and they saw it, and they didn't think it was, they thought it was a chronic problem. It wasn't anything that had just popped up. It wasn't anything to do with the virus. It was just something that's the only thing that they saw that was abnormal. And the cardiologist said he didn't have any abnormalities with his heart. And so that's an example of somebody that basically did go in, recovered, wasn't, you know, according to them, they didn't want to keep him. You know, they didn't think he needed to be in the hospital, even under observation, even though his oxygen levels got down to the low 90s, and because he collapsed in the bathroom. They found him on the floor. And they didn't think either of those were enough to be that concerned about. So he's an example. I gave the example of another person I know that basically I didn't see the test results. He claims he's been infected three times now. And the third time, he lost feeling in his limbs, and he couldn't walk, and then he could. You know, it was on and off, and he ended up in the hospital. And then he got discharged after a few days, but he had neurological issues. So heart issues, neurological issues, these are issues that are almost certainly related to the polyvasic plebiscite because the virus can attack a whole lot of different tissues. And they can be neurotropic, and they can be, you know, cause cardiac problems, and the cardiac problem, you know, we've mentioned these as far as athletes were concerned and how they've got, you know, evidence of heart damage even in asymptomatic cases that have been lab confirmed. And there's others you hear they've been discharged, but, you know, they just don't have the energy or the lung capacity they had previously. And, you know, they can do things, but they get tired and they got to kind of, you know, monitor their activity levels. They can't do what they used to do. And they, you know, they've been out of the hospital for months and they don't have any evidence that they've got the virus, but they've got evidence that they've got, you know, at least long-term damage, whether it's irreversible damage or not. You know, I think too early to say that. But, that's the whole point. The whole point is the virus can attack a whole lot of different organs, and you can get the virus under control, and you can get it down to non-detectable levels, and you can get discharged, and you can go home. But a lot of people just aren't 100%. You know, and they're not sure whether they're going to get to 100%, but they've been, you know, out of the hospital or tested negative for months, and they still have issues. And there are the long-termers that seem to have the virus pop up and go down and come back up again. So they just have these sporadic episodes, and they can pick up the virus during those episodes, and it doesn't last long. It goes back down again, but they're probably infectious, and they probably have long-term issues. So those are some of the reasons that, I mean, that's why Tony Fauci would say, well, you're talking about the death rate. And if younger people are getting affected, they do have a lower death rate. But that doesn't mean that their infections are without consequences, even if you exclude the fact that they're vectors to carry the virus to other people. They can have issues themselves, even though they recover.
How are they going to, when flu season hits, determine, they're going to have to test to find out who's got coronavirus, who has flu. They're going to have to test everybody thoroughly.
Yeah, they've got new tests that test for both viruses. So they'll test for the flu and they'll test for COVID. You know, with the same sample. I mean, you'll take swab and you'll basically put some of the sample in the well that's testing for influenza and some of the sample in the well that's testing for COVID.
Right.
And they'll test for both because, you know, like you say, or implied, the symptoms are very similar. And, there's no, I mean, the only way it'll be an easy call will be as if the COVID activities basically suppress the influenza, so there's not much influenza around. I mean, that's essentially mm-hmm. what happened with swine flu. With swine flu, mm-hmm. it outcompeted seasonal flu, so that in the fall of 2009, there was, if you were influenza A positive, you had swine flu. It totally knocked out the seasonal H1N1, and it totally knocked out the seasonal H3N2. And the only thing that was circulating in the fall of 2009 was swine flu. So you could take a simple influenza A test, and if it was positive, you had swine flu. You didn't have to go ahead and say, well, you know, is it seasonal flu, or is it seasonal H1N1, or is it seasonal H3N2, or is it swine flu, all three of which are influenza A. The answer was the swine flu. You don't have to bother testing for the other two because they're not circulating. So it's possible if flu is way down that people will, you know, physicians will know that if they've got these flu-like symptoms that, you know, they should be tested for COVID first. And, you know, if they're negative, then you can do something else. But they got the tests out that really test for both viruses simultaneously. So you basically, collect the sample and you run that test and you get the results at essentially the same time.
Right.
So there's ways to see how it's going. But, I mean, the numbers are starting to cause some concern. I mean, just to give you an idea, here in Pennsylvania, I want to talk about Pennsylvania a little bit. I've been sending you basically states that have 1,000 cases a day, and Pennsylvania got above 1,000 last week, and they've been about 1,300 every day. New York got above 1,000, and they've been now about 1,500 every day. Michigan's above 1,000 now. Illinois is up around 3,000 a day now. Florida's starting to creep up again. They're around 3,000 now. They've gotten down closer to 2,000. Texas is up. Today they were up to 4,000. Ohio is getting close to 2,000 every day now. Indiana's close to 2,000. Missouri's above 2,000. Wisconsin's up to 3,000 a day now. Wisconsin's filling up as far as the beds are concerned. They've been above 2,000 for a while, but now they're up to 3,000. And, you know, states that aren't that big, Oklahoma, you know, where Tulsa was, you know, they report like 1,500 every day, which is a lot for its population. And like I said, North and South Dakota, I mean, today South Dakota was 774 and North Dakota was 656. So in Montana, it's another one per capita wise, they had 722. There aren't that many people in any of those three states. They're not. Their population's low, and they've got, you know, 700-800 cases a day. And so that would be in the, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 for some of these bigger states on a per capita basis if they were at that level. So these states are getting up to these levels that I just read, and they're, you know, during the week they do get lower on Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, but you know, Tuesday through Friday, they're in this general ballpark. Right. And they're, you know, Anthony Fauci was saying he'd like to see U.S. numbers below 10,000 before they go into the fall, and they're nowhere near 10,000. They got down to 40,000, and now they're up to 55,000, and next week they'll be up at 60,000 or 70,000. So,
what do you think, Henry? We got just 5 minutes here. It's Friday. What do you think? What do you personally think the outcome of the election is going to be? Well, how's it going to play out in your worldview? What do you think is going to happen? People
in my real world view, I think it's going to be a landslide. Now, I'll try to give you one more boots on the ground. I went into Squirrel Hill today. Squirrel mm-hmm. Hill is where Tree of Life was. You know, there was that massacre. 11 congregants were killed.
Very heavy Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. Yeah.
Right. And by now, everybody kind of knows what happened because the shooter basically put on Gab. He kind of was posting on there pretty regularly, including the day he did the shootings. Right. So it was clear, you know, he went and he attacked that particular synagogue because they had held a fundraiser for Pious, which was an organization that helps refugees adapt. It used to be more for Jewish refugees. It was formed back in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. You know, Jewish don't really need that kind of help anymore. And so they basically helped other refugees. And the shooter basically saw that and saw that they were having the fundraiser. It was actually not even the main group at Tree of Life. There were like three different groups. There was the smallest one who was holding a fundraiser. And that's how he selected it. And he basically thanked Caius for telling him about the event before he did it. And he, you know, said, I don't care about the optics. I'm going in the morning he went in. So it was pretty clear, you know, he was worried about the invaders. I mean, he talked about invaders. It was pretty clear that he'd been listening to, you know, the BS about all these and invaders coming from Mexico or Central America, and he thought that they were, you know, going to destroy his way of life, and figured he had to go to the synagogue and start shooting people. And so everybody really knows that. And so I was at Squirrel Hill. I was actually within a block of the Tree of Life. I actually know it well. My daughter used to volunteer for the Children's Institute, which is literally across the street. They're both at the intersection of Shady and Wilkins, mm-hmm. one to the northeast.
What's the Children's Institute? What is that?
It's an institute for, you know, children with disabilities, and she would volunteer to mm-hmm. help that. And they happen to be literally across the street.
Is that part of the Jewish community, or is that for all children?
No, that's
for
all children.
Uh-huh.
But it is in Squirrel Hill, and it is across the street from the Tree of Life, literally. I mean, they're both at the same intersection.
Wow.
And I was a couple blocks away, and I did a count. I just did like a one square block, you know, like two blocks from Tree of Life, right in the heart of Squirrel Hill. And I saw 25 signs, and the number of Trump signs was zero. And then going there and coming, I saw another 25 signs. And, I just went down a couple streets, you know, a couple main streets, one to go and one to come. And, number of Trump signs there was zero. So there were 50 signs that I saw, all of which were Biden. So he's not going to get a whole lot of votes in Squirrel Hill. I can tell you that. And it's the same thing in our neighborhood. I mean, there are Trump signs, but it's kind of like it was in the Philadelphia area. It was, 90-10. And, Pennsylvania is listed as the state most likely to determine the election. That's the one that's going to tip the election one way or the other. And it's got like a 30% rate in the next state, you know, like Florida or Ohio, or, you know, it was, I don't even know if Ohio was there. Florida was, I think, second. They were about half that value. They were around 15%. So mm-hmm. Pennsylvania was the state that's really going to really call the election. And actually, the Republicans in the state were so worried about that they were going to have this election overview board or something, that they were going to monitor the ballots and potentially look at what was going on at the post office and have subpoena power and going to make all kind of delays on the values. They got really bad publicity for that, and they just called that off today. So Pennsylvania, I think, is allowed to start counting the ballots in the morning that come in the mail. They're going to get a lot of mail-in ballots. They're going to have record numbers. And it might take them a day or two, but Trump will have a really hard time winning without Pennsylvania. And he is not going to get to Pennsylvania, and it's not going to be close. And a lot of the states that were close or were red are close now because he's losing the independent vote. And so I think it'll be Biden in a landslide, is my prediction. And I don't think it's going to change, but that's what it looks like at this end.
All right.
Okay, so that's it. I had a few other things, but we'll touch on them next week. But it really focused on, Trump really being the source of the super spreader event 2 weeks ago, and that it's going to be a disaster. As a reference point, the CDC recommendation is that if you have severe COVID, and based on the three drugs he was getting, he had severe COVID, right, you are supposed to isolate for 20 days. And it's been 8. So he's talking about using 10 days as isolation, and that's for a very mild case. There's nothing that said he had a mild case yet. He's one of the only people in the world that got all three of those drugs, two of which are for advanced cases. He had an advanced case. He's supposed to isolate for 20 days, and he's going to do a rally a day starting on Monday, which is on day 10.
Going to go down in flames if he goes down, right?
So
that's it.
Well, no, it'll take a little while. By the time people realize they're infected, the election will be over. But all the people that see him are the ones that are going down in flames, the ones that come to the rally. But anyway, have a good weekend. We'll see how it looks next week. But
it's
going to go from bad to worse. Okay,
take care.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Okay, bye-bye. Thanks.
All right, there we go. Another week gone. Wow.